Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, May 5th. Public media funding at risk with the latest executive order issued by President Donald Trump. What does it mean for HPR? And now that the dust has settled with the legislative session winding up on Friday, we consider what lawmakers succeeded in getting agreement on with hot button issues. We take a look at the military leases at Pohakoloa on the Big Island. We hear from the Army about its environmental impact statement as it comes up before the State Land Board at the end of the week. How will tariffs affect the price of that Mother's Day lay? We check in with someone whose family has been in the business for three generations. And we learn more about merging science and culture in the classroom at a school on Molokai. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, National Public Radio, and the Public Broadcasting Service are pushing back on President Donald Trump's executive order to defund public media. We are joined live by HPR News Director Bill Dorman, who has more on the impacts of this order to public media and HPR. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Yes, within the continuing discussion, cuts, freezes, shrinking government, public media definitely a target. The latest round came last week. As you said, President Trump issued this executive order, which would block NPR and PBS from getting federal funding through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Now, the heads of both NPR and PBS say the president doesn't have the authority to do that. This may or may not wind up in court. Still need to see on that. But meanwhile, the heads of both organizations have been out talking about the broader, really, scope of attack when it comes to this administration and public media. Yesterday, they made a joint appearance on Face the Nation on CBS, where PBS CEO Paula Kerger made the point that political attacks on public media are not new, but some of these circumstances are new.
It is different this time, and I've been through these battles now for a number of years. I've been at PBS almost 20 years, and I remember even going back to the Newt Gingrich days. But this is different. They're coming after us on many different ways. We're waiting for a possible rescission of those funds that have already been appropriated. There was an effort within the FCC challenging our ability to accept sponsorships from corporations, which is something that we have worked with the FCC on for many, many years. There was the executive order. There was the effort to try to remove a few members of the CPB board. Mm-hmm. So we have never seen a circumstance like this. And obviously, we're going to be pushing back very hard, because what's at risk are our stations, our public television, our public radio stations across the country. We get 15% of our funding from the federal government. That's 1.5%, but that's an aggregate number. Some of our stations in small communities, it's 40 to 50% of their funding, and for them it's existential, and that's what's at risk if this funding goes away.
And you heard the PBS CEO Paula Kerger refer to rescission. That's a step hasn't been done yet, announced by the Trump administration. A lot of people are expecting this. An effort to rescind or claw back money Congress has already appropriated for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That's funded 2 years in advance, supposedly to avoid political heat on that. But it would have to go through both houses of Congress because Congress approves spending. But the bigger picture, really, overall, political tone and rhetoric with all of this. You can see this from the title of a congressional hearing that was held at the end of March. It was called the Anti-American Airwaves, Holding the Heads of NPR and PBS Accountable, held by a congressional subcommittee called DOGE, Delivering on Government Efficiency. And the subcommittee chair is Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. Here's part of her opening statement.
When Congress adopted the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, it did so because it thought at the time that federal dollars were needed to provide objective news and education content to the entire nation, including rural residents who lived off the grid. Fast forward a few decades, and a lot has changed. The invention of the internet, for instance, and social media, it's made news and information widely available to those living in remote areas. Americans are increasingly consuming digital media and podcasts. The audience of public radio and television is declining. And I know this because I represent a rural district where farmers listen to podcasts and internet-based news while they drive their tractors. At the same time, NPR and PBS have increasingly become radical left-wing echo chambers for a narrow audience of mostly wealthy, white, urban liberals and progressives who generally look down on and judge rural America.
Marjorie Taylor Greene in a hearing in late March. One of the witnesses in that hearing, by the way, who did talk about part of rural America was Ed Ullman. He's the president and CEO of Alaska Public Media, and he really gave that member-level perspective in talking about what local stations do for their communities.
The people of Alaska rely on public media to provide free, universal access to essential services in public safety, education, and community connections. This includes potentially life-saving alerts, updates on community affairs, coverage of state and local government, proven educational content engagement services, and local and national news. In many parts of Alaska and communities throughout the country, public media is often the only locally operated, locally controlled broadcasting service. We are more than nice to have. We are essential, especially in remote and rural places where commercial broadcasting cannot succeed.
Ed Ullman, the CEO of Alaska Public Media. And by the way, you can find a note from our president and CEO, Meredith Artley, on our homepage at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's headlined, "Memo from the CEO, Funding for Public Media is Increasingly Under Threat." Goes into more detail in terms of also a little bit about what we're doing, which including our day jobs. But it also answers some questions folks may have about how we're looking at this situation, because it's going to go on like this.
Yes. And I know, you know, people in the community have been reaching out to me, even my own family from the mainland, like, are you guys going to be okay?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and that's a variety of stories across the country with depending on the situations of each local station. We're relatively fortunate here, very fortunate here, in that we have such strong local support. 94% of our budget comes from local sources, 6% by way of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But that makes a huge, critical difference. It's about $500,000 for us if it would take away CPB funding. It would hurt for sure, but it's not an existential threat. But that's not the case for many stations.
Right. And you wonder about, yeah, the territories, you know, what their situation is and what their dependence is on those funds.
It's true.
Yeah. Critical stuff. But thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks.
We have been hearing from HBR's news director, Bill Dorman, about President Donald Trump's executive order concerning funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Our president and CEO, Meredith Artley, also released a statement on Friday. You can read it on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Tune in to HPR 2 tonight at 8 p.m. for another in our series of Hawaii Symphony Orchestra Masterworks concerts. Under the direction of Maestro Dane Lam, we'll hear Das Lied von der Erde, The Song of the Earth by Gustav Mahler. We'll also hear Crouching Tiger Concerto by Tan Dun and the premiere of The Grand Song by Huang Ru. That's tonight at 8 p.m. on HPR 2, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
Support for HPR comes from Osher Lifelong Learning Institute for ages 50 and older, with courses from art and film to history and gardening. Classes begin June 2nd, olliuhm.org.
So what did lawmakers actually pass on Friday, the final day of the legislative session? Here to pick up the pieces with us this morning is HBR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
You recovered?
Yeah. yes, and I think, it was such an exciting end of session. They passed a lot of different things. But the thing we do need to talk about at the top, I think, is the green fee that passed on Friday. And, this is Governor Josh Green's initiative of taxing tourists to pay for climate change initiatives. He's been pushing this for years, ever since he came into office.
Yeah, and it was a $25 per head thing, right?
Yes, exactly. And so the bill that they did eventually settle on was really a compromise between lawmakers and the governor. And House Vice Speaker Linda Ichiyama says, lawmakers have really wrestled with all these different versions of the concept over the years before settling on what they passed.
We figured the simplest would be to simply increase the existing transient accommodation tax, and it also, as a matter of fairness, to make sure that it applied to all types of transient accommodations, not just hotels or B&Bs, but also to cruise ships. And this funding is essential because it's really going to help us steward our natural resources and make sure that they're available for future residents and visitors for many years to come.
And, like you said, at one point it was charging tourists $25 when they arrive. And then at the start of the session, it was raising the transit accommodations tax up to 1.75%, so almost 2%, increasing that transit accommodation tax. But what they settled on is they're raising the transit accommodations tax by 0.75 percentage points, and that would bring it to 11% in total. It also applies that 11% tax to cruise ships, which are docking in Hawaii. Previously, cruise ships have not been paying TAT at all. And then it includes a provision where the governor will request that the extra tax proceeds from this increase will go to specific climate change resiliency efforts, and that budget would then need to be approved by the legislature. So the taxes increase is expected to bring in about $80 to $100 million that year, which sounds like a lot, but the need is around $500 million a year. So this is kind of just like a dent in that. But Governor Josh Green says, this commitment will make it easier to get other philanthropic partners to give to these climate issues here in Hawaii.
Now that we've demonstrated that the state of Hawaii will be committing $100 million a year as promised, there are a lot of people out there that are interested in matching us dollar for dollar for projects. And I would not be surprised if some of the super wealthy who have settled in Hawaii might want to help us. I've had from the get-go commitments from groups like Alaska Hawaiian Airlines that they would like to help us with these processes. Of course, they've gone through a lot of changes, but they were actually entertaining the idea of a voluntary fee that people could pay to help our environment. I expect this will now set off a domino effect of others that will want to support us.
And, hotels, of course, are not happy about this increase, but it's been made a lot more palatable because it's putting that TAT on cruise ships, which weren't paying at all.
Right, so be fair.
Yeah, right. They see it as more as like an equal playing field now. And also the funds can go to destination management for tourists, like beach improvement, maintenance projects, which would help, a lot of these hotels in Waikiki. In the past, I spoke with people in the hotel industry that say that, these types of increases probably won't deter the average tourist from coming, but where it will hit is large group bookings for things like conferences, where a small tax increase multiplied by a large number of rooms can actually come out to a pretty significant increase on these people's bills. So these bookings are usually made almost a year in advance, and they're kind of the foundation for many of these hotels. And now with the Hawaii Convention Center also out for renovations, it's hard to tell how much of an impact something like this is going to have.
Yeah, interesting. So what else should we be watching, now that we've put the session to bed?
Yeah, and this is obviously not the only thing that they passed. Lawmakers started this session saying they wanted to address illegal fireworks and soaring insurance prices, and property insurance prices. And they did pass pretty significant legislation on both of those topics. So they passed a measure that changes the definitions of fireworks to make it easier for prosecutors to win and bring cases. This was a huge issue when they were trying to crack down on these illegal fireworks. So they're hoping that fixing these types of definitions are really going to help in that area. It increases penalties on some of those offenses, and passed another measure that allows drone footage to be used as evidence in these illegal fireworks cases. Another measure that passed was property insurance stabilization, which would allow the state to offer insurance policies to those who have lost coverage. House Consumer Protection Committee Chair Scott Matsuyoshi says, you know, while this measure focuses on condos above four stories tall, he wants to work on legislation in the future to help owners of single family homes.
While we're offering some relief through condo insurance right now, hopefully we can get further funding and further expand this program to help not only all the condominium associations in Hawaii, but also to start dipping into hopefully single family residential and other different sorts of property ownership for more affordable insurance for Hawaii residents.
And, you know, other things that didn't pass that might come back next session. Online sports betting made it to conference this year, which is one of the last steps of the legislative process. And ultimately, they decided not to pass it, but they said they would be working on it in the interim. And maybe recreational marijuana legalization, which also died earlier this session. But because we're at the beginning of the two-year biennium, all the bills that didn't make it to the end this year can be rolled over next year at the same point that they were stalled in this past session.
Yeah, and, you know, we did hear lawmakers say that depending on what happens with the federal government and federal funding, they will likely come back for special session. And they have already set aside those dates.
Yeah, and so that was one thing that was asked a lot of, you know, House Speaker Nadine Nakamura when we were asking, you know, what would trigger something like this? Why would we come back from for a special session? And, you know, she says that they're going to be closely monitoring federal funding impacts. The budget does set aside $200 million for this purpose, and they would come back for a special session if it's needed.
When it comes to the point where we need up to the $200 million set aside, and when both houses, the House and Senate, agree, that's when we would convene. So we're going to work very closely with the Green administration so we have real-time information as the cuts become available.
And so this $200 million is part of what's called the carryover balance. And basically, to have kind of a healthy financial outlook for the state needs to set aside about a $500 million carryover. So they already put that $500 million aside. And on top of that, they have this $200 million extra of carryover for these federal funding impacts. Originally, they were talking about putting it into the rainy day fund, that reserve fund that the state has. That's now at about $1.5 billion, I believe. But they decided ultimately not to put this $200 million into the rainy day fund because they wanted to be more flexible and reactive. Funds in the rainy day fund, in order for that money to be used, the legislature has to authorize that with a two-thirds vote majority on both the House and the Senate. So it's a lot harder to access those funds purposefully because they're supposed to be used in emergencies, but they are keeping this $200 million separate from that so that it's easier to allocate in the interim if they need to come back for special session.
Makes sense.
Yeah. They also set aside $500 million in grants for nonprofits that lost federal funding. The selection committee for that will be made of two representatives and two senators, and the meetings for those will be closed to the public.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that was something that was a little bit debated on the floor about whether or not that would be allowed or not. Currently, the House of Representatives is being sued for a similar issue with the House Rules Committee not holding public meetings. And so we'll see kind of where that shakes out. But yeah, as you said, lawmakers have blocked off three dates in August, October, and November for potential special session on the floor of the Senate on the last day. Senate President Kochi said, you know, November is most likely if they do have to come back.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we just don't know. Lots of uncertainty. And, you know, particularly if the safety net programs are cut, you know, Medicaid, SNAP, you know, that kind of thing. They do want to help those most needy families.
Yeah, exactly. So they'll be watching closely.
Yeah. All right. Well, we know what you'll be doing here this fall. Thanks so much,
Thanks.
Ashley. We have been talking to HPR's Ashley Matsuo about this year's legislative outcomes as the 2025 session has ended. You can read her and Mark Liddell's analysis of seven important bills at hawaiipublicradio.org.
The name Jose Cuervo is on bottles in bars and liquor cabinets worldwide, but the actual man behind the tequila brand is an enigma.
Almost nothing has been recorded about him personally and about being the controller of this massive empire.
How Jose Cuervo shaped modern-day Mexico. That story and top global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
May happens to be Military Appreciation Month, and this week the State Land Board takes up the final environmental impact statement on the proposed leases at the Pohakaloa Army Training Area on the island of Hawaii. This morning we talked to Alice Roberts, manager for the U.S. Army Pacific Training Land Retention Program. The military's 65-year land lease is coming up, and the EIS is up for a vote by the Board of Land and Natural Resources on Friday. The Army pays $1 a year for the lease on land that it considers critical to its national security readiness mission. It's proposing that it retains a smaller training footprint, but the lease is complicated as the lands covered under that lease are not only ceded lands, but also conservation land, which is not compatible with the military training. The fixes could take a much longer process than the lease deadline allows. Here's Roberts detailing what's involved.
What our EIS focuses on is how much land to retain, not how to retain it. And as we've moved through the process, we've discovered that the retention methods, which would be a lease or fee simple acquisition, both of those have very high administrative hurdles. So for a lease, because the majority of the state land at Pohakaloa Training Area is zoned conservation district, a new lease would be incredibly difficult because military training is not an authorized use on conservation district lands. So we would have to go through an administrative rule change, an application for that, which can be contested.
That would be a long, drawn-out process, and the leases are up pretty quick.
Yes, and Chair Chang has made that very clear. So then the other path is a fee simple retention, but that would require a two-thirds majority of the state legislature because they are ceded lands.
Wow. Okay. Very complicated.
Yes. So we have brought the concept of a land exchange up, and any further discussion on that will be, again, once we get through the NEPA process. We cannot enter any kind of formal negotiation until the NEPA record of decision is signed, and that will be later this summer.
Okay, and then for folks who are not familiar with NEPA?
Sorry, it's the National Environmental Policy Act, and Hawaii has its own version, HEPA, which is what will be decided. The HEPA portion is what the board decides on, not the federal NEPA portion, if that makes sense.
But the bottom line is that when people think, oh, the leases are up, do we just re-sign another lease? It should be fairly quick, yay or nay. But it sounds like there's just so many layers depending on which route to take.
Yes.
If you could spell out for our listeners why this land is so important to the Army as a training facility.
So at Pohakaloa Training Area, it's very important because it's the only area in Hawaii that supports larger unit training, and both for like collective live fire training and for maneuver training. And it's the primary tactical training facility for all Hawaii-based units. And it is used not only by the Army, primarily the 25th Infantry Division, but also by the Marine Corps, the National Guard, also Hawaii first responders, to include both the police department and the various fire departments. So they use these facilities that are on state-owned land as well as the military. So that's important to understand as well.
And what type of training are we talking about? Are we talking about, you know, firing ranges? Are we talking about bringing in tanks? I mean, spell it out for our listeners.
There are no tanks that are used. However, it's mostly artillery training. So indirect firing from different weapon systems. So the submittal notes for the board hearing this Friday, there's a majority of the firing points are located on state-owned land. By the terms of the lease, we can't fire into that land. We can fire from that land. So it's important that those areas are maintained so that they can continue to use the weapon systems and the range configuration as it currently stands.
And talk about the military's willingness to reduce the footprint.
So in looking at all of this, the Army has taken a very deliberate approach to examining what lands are required to be able to still meet the training requirements. Those are represented in the EIS. Alternative 3, which is a minimum retention, would allow that the Army can continue to do the training. However, there's large conservation units. So the natural resources team up there maintains 37,000 acres of fenced conservation units where threatened and endangered species are propagated and conserved. So that falls within the state-owned land as well, and the Army would prefer to continue to maintain that.
Yes, I mean, that program is a very fine program in propagating the native plants and native species.
Yes, it's actually incredible. There are 6 species that only occur at Pohakoloa, and they have kept those going, which I think is just remarkable. But they also have conservation measures for a total of 26 federally listed species.
So that preferred alternative would keep that portion
in hold? It would keep that conservation unit under Army control, yes.
The alternative to lease the 19,000 acres?
The 3,000 acres that are being released back to the state are north of DKI Highway. It's essentially the foot slope of Mauna Kea, not currently used for training. And it has very little to no infrastructure on it.
What else can you tell us? Because in previous hearings, the public has been vocal. You know, there's a segment that does not want to re-up those leases. There's a segment that wants the military to pay more than a dollar a year for those lands. And there are folks that are pushing for something more a fair market value. And then, you know, there's the concern about cleanup. The community is harboring a lot of resentment, you know, for Kaho'olawe. And the cleanup is still going on over there. There are concerns about Red Hill. And I know they're, you know, that's the Navy, you know, so the different branches we're talking about. But still, you know, there is the community concern that either the military pays more for that land and does a better job of cleaning up the property.
Right. There are a couple of key points in that the state-owned land that we currently use, the units that use those lands have to clean up after every exercise. So pick up brass, any boxes, any other rubbish. But there's an accountability on that. It's got to be done to standard, or they got to go back out, or the range has to clean it up. So there is a constant cleanup. Now, the impact area where larger munitions go from the indirect fire, that is not regularly cleaned up. But I think there's something important to understand about 95% of the munitions expended at PTA, Pohakoloa Training Area, are small arms. For larger munitions, about 80% of those are inert. That means it doesn't have any explosive component. So it's not as if the Army is actually sending explosive bombs every time they train. So there's that point. But we've also, out of the Ching versus Isla lawsuit and the state Supreme Court ruling on that, DLNR has conducted inspections of the state-owned land. There have been some minor corrective actions, just like, hey, we saw some spent rounds. You need to, and most of these are historic debris, and it's hard. It's like dark gray shell casing on dark gray lava. But for the most part, We've had good marks on those. We have put those inspection reports on the EIS website so that people can have access to them. We've had those requests from people so they can understand. So there is cleanup that goes on as part of the training exercises. Also, I'd like to point out that military units are required. It is mandatory for them to go through both natural resources and cultural resources training before they can even use the range, so that they know the areas that that are absolutely off limits and what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do.
For years, for decades, we've heard about the concern for depleted uranium.
This has been a really hard subject to get around because for 15 years now, there's been a lot of vocal concern, and understandably, in the early 1960s, there were a weapon system called the Davy Crockett weapon system, and there were about 400 rounds that were deployed to PTA. The use of these was first identified in the early 2000s. And so from 2007 to 2009, there was research and testing and surveys conducted. So that was like both visual ground surveys, aerial surveys, dust samples. This was done by a contractor, Cabrera Services. There's no DU, depleted uranium, on state-owned land. Between 2009 and 2010, there was a year-long airborne monitoring program, and all of those samples came back within naturally occurring levels.
So it's not a public risk, threat?
No. And in 2011, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did a health risk assessment, and they said that the current land use does not pose a risk to human health for users or offsite population. And the State Department of Health concurred.
That was Alice Roberts, Program Manager for U.S. Army Pacific Training Land Retention, who we talked to this morning. The State Land Board votes on whether to accept or reject the EIS for Pohakoloa at its Friday meeting.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Today on The Daily, at a time of enormous economic upheaval and uncertainty triggered by President Trump's trade war, we asked you, our listeners, what you want to understand about this financial moment. I'm Mike Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30 following Marketplace.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
You know, Mother's Day is this weekend, and graduations are just around the corner. It is the busiest time of year for laymakers, but tariffs are raising the price of flowers, and families are feeling a squeeze in their budget. So what does it mean for the business of lay? Are you making your own? Are you turning to lay made from ribbons, feathers, fabrics, and other materials? Well, the conversation's D.W. Gibson. Talk with Nick Lee from Cindy's Lay Shop. Lee is a third-generation lay maker, running the shop that his grandmother started in 1959. He began by describing his reaction to President Donald Trump's Liberation Day tariff announcement back in April.
The timing couldn't be more inconvenient. We are thankfully in a 90-day pause just for all countries except for China, set at a 10% rate. For the majority of our flowers, we import them in. Hawaii is not the agriculture economy that it once was. I don't think that we have the I think cheapness of real estate or like the labor force to be able to have that will come into reality just to be able to onshore. The first like rates were announced by President Trump. He unveiled a chart, I think, at a press conference, and he set 36% for Thailand. And that we would not have been able to stomach just because of the seasonality of the business that we're in which, you know, by late April, we do start graduation season. We do get into the college graduations like before even the local graduations over here. We saw different ways by which I think the brokers behaved with how they would pass on the cost like to their accounts, like such as ours for wholesale to retail. The majority of them passed on the full 10% to us. And gosh, we're thankful that there is a pause, at least to get us over the busy time. I think that everyone in our niche industry can stomach 10%. But when this 90-day pause, pending any other changes, you know, for that timeline, once it ends kind of around July 10th, I believe would be the end date. I don't know. If it did go into effect at 36% for like the tariffs imposed on all imports from Thailand, I don't think that we would have passed on the entire cost to the customer, I think that we would have locked in the people that ordered early just with the pricing that they gave, and we would have just ate the loss in margin.
Yeah. And so you're dealing with that 10% now, which you're saying wholesalers, suppliers have added to the prices that you pay. What are you doing right now with that 10%?
I think typically during graduation season, we do price increases. We do, just because of seasonality, price increases like from the farm to the broker and then ultimately to the retailer. You know, they do raise price, but I would say across the board, you know, we're paying 10% more. And for what we're charging, I think our prices are almost the same as last year. I think we are charging more on local product, ironically. It's a lot more scarcer. Say, Plumeria, Crown Flower, Ohialii, just maybe the flowers, the pua and the lei that are grown and sold or like made, say, like out of a yard or like, say, the few commercial farms left here. Even tuberose and ginger, which is quite scarce. We came out of 2 weeks of like intermittent rain, but because it's scarcer and that's what local tastes and preferences want, we do charge a premium as we go through this work marathon over the next, gosh, 6-7 weeks of graduation.
And have there been any disruptions so far in terms of supply?
That's an interesting question. I wish one of our suppliers was calm enough for me to ask that. But one of the entry-level salespeople, just with one of our biggest suppliers, she had told me that they're not taking anything additional. They're at max capacity. And I don't know if that's just their accounts or their customer base all ordering more, or whether it has something to do with the tariffs.
Not necessarily understanding the why, but understanding from at least that supplier that the supply is maxed out in that case.
That's right.
I'm just curious because I've seen so many things in the last few weeks, anecdotally, talking to friends and family, online, Etsy and so forth, so many alternatives to the traditional flower lei, you know, people experimenting with feathers and crocheting leis and ribbon leis. Does your business model accommodate some of that as well? Obviously, you're focused primarily on traditional leis, but is there some other space there that you try to capture?
It's an existing part of like our offering, but we do have like artificial leis kind of made with more synthetic material, like say artificial mylei, like tea leaf, like vili combination, plumeria, poi poi style leaves, like say a dendrobium 2 orchid. We haven't grown it in response to all of this, although we do carry, I think, a minimal amount of crocheted leaves, like more like yarn and twine. And we have made ribbon leaves in-house. We do carry lo'i, kind of like woven, kind of put together like locally as well, where we do make money leaves. Those are popular for birthdays and graduation. I think we've committed kind of more orders for that this year than the previous year. But just say for those that want to get an assortment, I think people's behavior kind of with shopping right now, just given the cost of things, the cost of leis, the cost of flowers, I think people are spending a bit more money, but they're buying less leis overall. They're kind of meeting themselves in the middle, but also deciding, oh, I'm going to buy a candy lei. I'm going to go to Long's or Ben Franklin or Big Island Candies. Like, oh, I'll get something to just cover up my kid. And I think for Hawaii here, that just with the local graduation, there's more the culture of trying to get Lays to cover up their child's head. I don't think there's too much of that on the mainland. There's less people in the crowd or in the graduating class or that cohort that will be wearing with Lays. I think it's more quality over quantity, but I think it is also a little bit more subdued. Like for the Lays that we're sending for mainland graduations, we might be doing like a set, say like one lei kui style, kind of like around the neck, and then one lei po'o as well, kind of like matching color, or just one lei overall that's pretty substantial, kind of well-sized, like good for photo taking, like in their cap and gown.
Yeah. I wonder if you have any thoughts just in terms of if the tariffs do go back into effect, if the pause ends, how do you see the tariffs affecting the culture and tradition of lei making here in Hawaii?
I think it can have like positive and negative effects. There's a lot of like artisan makers like on Instagram, like Facebook Marketplace that use materials that are grown out of a backyard, or they go forage. They kind of drive around the North Shore, kind of what have you. I could see that being a boon for those and people with, I guess, peculiar tastes that would want to wear just more local leis. But at the same time, I think that just the overall demand, it's really spread out, but I do see it being very high. And then without imported material to complement, you know, there is a place like for the quality of the indigenous or not even indigenous kind of material, kind of woven patterns, but more like the local flowers that have had a place in Hawaii for, like, say, 100, 200 years. I can see it driving up the price. I can see it being kind of a strain on the local, like, kind of lei makers that do design with the backyard material, that do more artisanal grown, that do like hand make everything, you know, one lei by one lei. And collectively, we to be able to do the output that we do, it's kind of amazing. And I know of like independent lei makers where they've done it before and now they choose to just do it for friends and family. They've told themselves, oh no, I'll get burnt out or my hands will be sore, like kind of working with this if I open myself up to like doing this like full time. I think that a lot of people that do this kind of cultural practice, they want to keep it a hobby on some level, but it is like a side gig.
I was intrigued by what you said at the outset of our conversation in terms of how a lot of people might be surprised by how few of the flowers for lei making come from the islands. And you mentioned that that redounds to issues about labor supply and support for agricultural endeavors. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that, because ostensibly the goal of the tariffs is to create situations where more things are produced within the 50 states. Do you see that being an effect the tariffs could have on lei making in the long run?
I don't think so, but maybe my view is narrow. I think that just with the cost of real estate to do commercial farming and with development going towards kind of more condominiums versus yard, or I hear of like houses being bought and trees being cut down. I guess the old owner's pukenikeni tree or plumeria trees, I don't necessarily see it in the cards. At the end of the day, I think the cost for leasing, whether it be like state land or Kamehameha school land, from what I've heard from people that farm, it's not so bad. I mean, to buy like land, that's an enormous endeavor, and to pay off a loan or mortgage on that land. But the cost to fertilize, the cost to plow the land, to be able to set up some kind of like fencing, to be able to set up some kind of security protocol, to be able to procure all your materials, and you're so dependent on the weather, you know, such as farming, that I think would be the bigger variable cost.
Well, in trying to end on a positive note, I guess I would ask, do you see a future where lei making endures and continues to thrive, but becomes perhaps more dynamic in terms of what we look to include in our lei making and how we become more contemporary or more varied in terms of what we can include and what can become a lei?
I think leis will survive. I think leis will find a way, to quote Jurassic Park. I can see it. The flowers might be different. I think change is constant, whether it be fabric, whether it be actual flowers. And I think somehow flowers will always be in lei making, at least on Oahu. I think people in Hawaii and outside of Hawaii, they've embraced the tradition, the culture of lei as a way to celebrate and mark these rites of passages, milestones, occasions, or even just casual gifting, welcoming a friend at the airport, just bringing a lei over to the holidays to give to your parents, your mom. I don't know how that future will exactly be, but I think leis will remain in some way, shape, or form.
That was HBR's E.W. Gibson talking with Nick Lee of Cindy's Lay Shop. How are you dealing with the rising costs of lay? Leave us a voicemail at 808-792-8217 or email us talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Making science relevant in the classroom by using culture. Joining us this morning is HBR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so you've been finding some really interesting stuff that's going on in our schools.
Yeah, so Kavika Gonzalez is an award-winning fifth-grade educator at Kauna Kakai Elementary School on Molokai. And he came up with a really innovative project designed to connect Hawaiian culture through the game of ulumaika, or Hawaiian bowling, with computer science and technology. So this started last year, and they began by carving and shaping the physical ulumaika made of stone. So they're sort of round stones that are rolled through pins. And then they scanned them into digital images. And from there, they created computer games, they created ulumaika apps, ulumaika robots that can roll the ulumaika stones, Minecraft games that they developed, 3D printed ulumaika replicas. I mean, they did incredible things. So Gonzalez explains how it all fits together.
We learned that as we learn new technology, like developing apps and things, that it wasn't just about rolling rocks on the ground, that it was much more than that. And when the students were designing the apps that you can control the angle, the spin, the speed, the strength of the ulumaika, now we're having an understanding, oh, it's much more than just rolling rocks on the ground. Or when the students were actually creating these 3D models on the computer, oh, wait, this size is better than this size, or this shape, you know, is better to create ulumaika. And so using these tools, we have a better understanding of ulumaika and our culture as well.
That's really so interesting, you know, because you do the 3D and then you just, go to a wholly, totally different level.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, the traditional Hawaiian game of playing ulumaika really, you know, they went hand in hand with the computer modeling, helping them play, you know, with the physical ulumaika stones better as well by learning all of the science and math that goes into it to roll it accurately. And it's just incredible. So this is an after-school program with fifth and sixth graders, and they presented at the state capitol during Education Week. Talking to them, you know, computer coding is so far beyond, you know, my comprehension, but seeing these kids just so engaged is really inspiring. And so they took it to so many different levels. And one aspect of the project was making a film centered around ulumaika with Matt Yamashita, who is an award-winning filmmaker from Molokai. And so he and Kavika Gonzalez have been friends since elementary school themselves. And they were actually on an airplane to Oahu, and Kavika told him about his film idea to get the kids involved in you know, potentially creating a film. And Matt said, you know, he was actually already thinking about making an ulumaika film. So it's kind of an unusual coincidence. He tells about it here.
It was an interesting plane ride. I got really excited. I was like, well, yeah, man. So I had my own basic fundamental premise for a storyline. He had one as well, and we kind of melded the two ideas and came up with a rough idea, but wanting the kids to kind of really develop it into the story that it became. So that was kind of step one, was talk story, and then just a commitment on my part to volunteer to work with the kids on a number of days after school, you know, with the intent of really walking them through the entire filmmaking process, right? From pre-production through production to post-production, and also giving them a basic understanding of the workings of each of those phases of production.
Oh gosh, and Matt is such a terrific filmmaker, so creative, and that's awesome that he's getting involved in this project.
He is. So he has a background in film education on Molokai, actually, before he went into his career as an independent filmmaker. And so education is really a passion of his, getting, you know, youth and students involved in the art of filmmaking. So the Kankakai School students acted in the film. They were involved in every aspect of the production. You know, there's a storyline with an antagonist and a protagonist competing in Ulumaika in the Makihiki Games. And so it's a 6 to 7 minute film. They just wrapped up production and filming, and Matt is now in the editing process, and he hopes to get the kids a rough edit, you know, before they leave on summer break in the next couple of weeks. Yamashita said he's not sure what the film's future will hold, but, you know, he thinks it might get into the Hawaii International Film Festival.
It's their film, so it's going to be up to them what they want to do with it and how they want to use it. Definitely, I think, community screenings on Molokai. You know, that's part of the process too, right, is having the kids create something and then share it and then see, witness how their work impacts an audience. To me, that's one of the most important aspects of filmmaking, especially for people that are getting into this industry or this art. The most rewarding part is often just to see, you know, how your work impacts people.
Yeah, I think that would be a great idea for a short, and maybe they can screen the film over at that theater there on Molokai.
Who knows? Yeah, that's true. And so developing more education programs for film is something that Yamashita says he's been talking about with the new Maui County Film Commissioner, Brian Cohn. He's from Maui, and it sounds like they'll be pushing to get more opportunities for students' equipment in the classrooms for students wanting to, you know, pursue and explore filmmaking. So it sounds like there'll be more opportunities coming down the line, hopefully. And, you know, Kavika's project with his elementary students, you know, he said it was really just all about exploring these different things and helping the students find out what they're interested in. You know, in addition to the computer science aspect, the filmmaking aspect, you know, they're also working on a podcast. And so his creativity and really guiding these kids to find their own interests and pursue those is really inspiring. He said he's also taking this to the next level and exploring a virtual reality Ulumaika where on Oculus. And so using that, you know, friends could play Ulumaika virtually, you know, across the country. And so just really cool seeing, you know, these endless possibilities that they're exploring.
Yeah, kudos to him for coming up with this innovative way to challenge the kids in so many different, you know, levels. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be exciting to see where it goes, as well as where these kids, you know, end up taking their interests.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Catherine, for highlighting this story.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from HBR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. You can look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. That's it for today. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the preemptive strike the president levied against Hawaii in its legal challenge against the oil companies. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.